Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Back, or welcome to the second act of my chat with two great thoroughbreds of the theatre and the concert hall, two spectacular people. Sam Mendes and Alison Balsam, director and trumpet player extraordinaire, maestro and maestra. Here they are.
Stage Door Johnny Company, beginners please for act two. Ms. Balsam, Mr. Mendes, and Mr. Cake to the stage, please. This is your beginners.
Ali, Sam has been everybody's dad in his professional life, sort of from the get-go. From the minute he put his arm around Judy Dench at 24 and said, I've got you, Jude. Or when she tried to do something in a scene, you said famously, well, you can try it like that, but it won't work. 24. Do you think that, talking about anxiety, do you think that's, you mentioned, Sam, it takes a toll, but you push it down somewhere or you can't appear to show the difficulty of that. Do you think that takes a toll on him, being everyone's dad?
No, I don't actually, curiously. I think it sort of adds to his rich palette. I think he's a big match player and he loves to step up to that challenge. But he does, you know, he can really lose his shit about the remote control not working. The small things that tip him completely over the edge. But the big things, he's got this amazing ability, especially when there's some, you know, like a big thing with the kids or something serious. But he goes incredibly calm and goes into this place where he's like, he works through everything really quickly, like what's the best scenario? How can we sort this out? And he's an amazing person to have around. When it's important and you need some serious advice, you need it quickly, he's decisive and you're very good at that kind of thing. So I don't think that's taking its toll, like it's costing him the way that some things cost, you know, and you feel like you never get them back. Like when Emily was talking about, I get so nervous about being on stage. I love it, but it costs me so much. Mm. I don't think that's quite what you experience. I think you love that sense of responsibility.
No, I do. And it is right that it's the small things. I'll tell a brief story. We were shooting on the Thames. We were doing Spectre on the Thames in the middle of the night on a launch. You find yourself in movies in the strangest places, you know, and eating at the strangest times. And I suddenly became aware that at 2 a.m. I was really hungry.
Can I just interrupt and say the word hangry?
Hangry, yes. Yeah, I was hangry. And they said, well, you know, catering is closed for the night, but there is someone, he's coming back and he can make some sausage rolls. I said, fantastic. Sausage rolls, just what I feel like, sausage rolls. So we were shooting away, and then this tiny launch came out towards the, you know, this sort of little dinghy, man, sort of on the, you know, holding this Tupperware box, which I assume contained the sausage rolls. It did indeed, and I ate one, and I felt elated, and I was in my moment of, you know, joy. I said, everyone, have a sausage roll, you know, fatal. It's a film set, of course. And I turned around from my second sausage roll, empty. It was an empty thing, you know. And that was the moment I'd really lost my shit. Who's eaten all the sausage rolls?
You know, so that story is all better for the fact that you already had one.
I know. And I offered them, you know, and I thought, I want to be generous, but not that generous. You can't eat all the fucking sausage rolls.
Quite right. Spectre was your second bomb. So it's like, I want one sausage roll for each one of these bastards that I've had to direct. Who took them all? That's very good. Sam, what about Ali's anxiety or performance stuff? Do you see it taking a toll on her, or is it a similar sense of performance animal getting ready?
Well, it was really hearing what she talked about earlier, but I do think that she has a performance persona to a degree, a kind of game face, and it is often to do, you know, she looks incredible on stage. What you talk about when you watch her on the YouTube clips and stuff like that, the way she walks out, the way she, you know, she's already doing it. You know, the performance has begun because she has to take, she can't go, right, thanks very much, everybody. Right, now I have to be, and take the breath. The breath has been taken metaphorically an hour earlier. That's already happened. And I think that, and she comes out with all the energy that a great performer has. You know, I hate to say this, it's much, much more difficult for women. I think it's an incredible achievement that what she has done, not only in the classical music, you know, industry, but in what is, until she arrived, a very male-dominated sector of the classical music, which was brass playing, and particularly trumpeters, you know, to not only be a top trumpeter, but to be a soloist, you know, and walk into every, I mean, I ask you to imagine every top orchestra in the world going, really? You're the soloist, are you? Come on then, show us. This is rehearsals, you know, and just stare them down and play. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, you know, I'm not part of that, you know, world, but it's a tricky world. You know, there's some patronizing people. There's a lot of received wisdom. There's a lot of, we've done it this way before. It's not as free as a theater. It's not as open. It's not as, you know, diverse. And there she was, you know, and I think that she has changed the way that, you know, women trumpeters are perceived. I mean, you see her legion of fans, you know, boys and girls, I mean, men and women, but huge numbers of female trumpet players have been drawn to the profession by her. And it's amazing, but it's cost her. And it costs her because she's also a woman and she's a mum and she's pulled in all directions like all mums. And what she does, the practice happens at home. You see, my luck is that, well, I've got to practice, you know. But if she had this sort of lovely demarcated space that was what I have for rehearsals, where she just had to leave the house because everyone was waiting for her, she would be rehearsing all the time, right? I mean, not all the time. She'd rehearse enough and it would be nicely clean, the difference between the domestic and the professional. But the problem is that classical musicians have to rehearse at home or in their own space, and they have to be self-motivated. And in the case of the trumpet, like Ali says, it's like a physical, it's like being an athlete. There are hundreds of muscles around the mouth that have to stay working. Otherwise, they atrophy, you know, and you know, it's just a workout. And the sound of Ali practicing is sometimes beautiful, but more often than not, it is just grinding out the scales and grinding out the, and it's, you know, she's just doing the hard yards. She's doing whatever the version of pull-ups and push-ups that she has to do to just keep it alive. And sometimes, this is a remarkable thing, I think. I didn't realize until I met her. She'll practice and practice, but on the day of the performance, she won't practice at all because she can't, because she has right. to leave it for performance. So the crucial, you know, what for us would be the last dress rehearsal before the first preview, nothing. She can't even blow into the bloody thing. She has to wait. This agonizing, well, you know, maybe for, you know, a little toot, but you don't basically practice. You know.
Got all the technical terms.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. And then she'll just walk on and nail it, not having played at all for a day, you know, basically. And that's amazing to me. I mean, the chutzpah is extraordinary.
I did a competition when I was really young. There was a great French trumpeter called Maurice André. The Maurice André trumpet competition I did when I was about 20, 21. In the first round, there were hundreds of us. And we all had to play the first movement of the Telemann concerto, which is very slow and very high and never just doesn't stop, just goes and goes and goes. It was a brilliant 2-minute piece to just wipe out 80 trumpet players at a time. And I could hear in all the practice rooms down the corridor, I could hear all the guys like, just checking. Yep, can still get my top D. Yep. Just check again. Oh, I might check again. And I could hear everyone. And sure enough, by the time they went out, no, couldn't get the top D. Oh, wow. I even had a colleague of mine who fainted playing the piece and fell off the front of the stage. And I knew that if I was going to get through the first round of that competition, I was just going to sit in that dressing room and wait until the moment where I was going to come out and play. So it's a risky strategy. But
wow.
Yeah, that's the one thing that's really, is a real challenge with, you know, playing the trumpet, that you have to, and actually with the recording I just made, it's like listening to some of the takes. It's like with the orchestra, we all get really honed and sort of meld as one by take sort of 4, 5, 6. It's all really, really coming together. It's sort of completely unconscious, but it just sounds better. Everything's just getting more and more as one. My chops are just getting less and less fresh. So there's only really one take where those two things go like that. And so, yeah, it's a high wire act.
extraordinary. Speaking about the athletic pursuit of it, you said something magnificent in an interview, and it's all sometimes a bit iffy quoting back people's comments to them because they may disown them and you may have moved on or you might be a different person. But there was something you said a while ago, which was that you didn't think that you would qualify for the trumpet Olympics, the final of the trumpet Olympics. There was something about, you know, that people can play faster, people can play higher, people can play louder. But you said what you found at a certain point was an artistry beyond the sheer athleticism of it, which has been the sustaining influence of your career. The thing that essentially lives beneath the music, your feeling for it, your connection to it, your interpretation of it. And I'm just curious to know from both of you, was there a moment, a piece you were working on, an experience you had that you can remember opening up that different portal of expression?
I don't think I can. I don't have a specific moment. I don't think I've ever been interested in being the best technical player of the trumpet. And actually, even if I wanted to be, any of us professional trumpeters, if you put in enough hours, you probably can do a lot of flashy fireworks because it's monkey training. To put the hours in, you can probably do it. People don't find that very engaging after a couple of minutes. They might be like, wow, that's impressive. But then they just emotionally switch off. You know, we all know what that's like. It's cool and then it's not cool and then you're bored and then you want to go home. So you need to find a way to make people just stay with you. And I think that is like storytelling, whether it's, you know, in the theatre with what you two do or whether it's what we do, which is much more abstract. But it's like, just stay with me on this journey for the entire time that I'm here. And I think that's what I realised at quite a young age. And, you know, one of the things I love to do, I'm not really sure why, I'm not a particularly religious person, but I love playing in big churches, cathedrals, abbeys with a big, you know, the organ of Westminster Abbey or some huge, fantastic organ and a great player, of course. And there's some great repertoire. It does feel like a sort of spiritual experience. And the two instruments, weirdly, even though one's like this big and one's bigger than this theatre, they're a perfect marriage of sonic resonance. And it is one of the most like profound experiences of my life to do a concert like that. And so I think that's one of those moments where it's like, this is cool. You know, we're in this space built in, you know, the 14th century or, you know, if you're in King's College Chapel or whatever. And it feels very, very privileged.
Sam, can you think of any moments where you found a deeper understanding of what you do, I suppose, is what I'm asking?
I mean, you know, I want to say every time I do something, if it's gone okay, I feel I've gone another step down the road. But I always have the image that always comes to me, if you know the Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, the Buñuel film, where they're always, you know, keeps cutting back to them. They're just walking down this road and they never arrive. That's the road I always feel I'm on. You know, you're journeying, you know, and I definitely feel recently, I felt for me, Lehman Trilogy was a moment for me that I felt I achieved something that I hadn't before, that was a kind of marriage of various parts of the way I've worked. And I look at it now, we're lucky enough to have had various iterations of the show, you know, one, a couple of casts, one in London again, and now one is out internationally. And I looked at it in the rehearsal room and I couldn't remember doing it. I couldn't remember how I'd come up with all those solutions. It was a dance. It was a much more instinctive part of myself. And not only could I not remember it, but I couldn't work out how I'd done it in such a short time, relatively. 3.5 hours of, you know, this thing with three actors. And I definitely feel like I get into the state of being less conscious of what I'm doing and less self-conscious, which of course is the enemy to all performing arts or anything creative. When I was a student, I was lucky enough to work at the Guggenheim Collection in Venice as an intern. She bequeathed in her will, Peggy Guggenheim, that the gallery should be run on a day-to-day basis by students, people who are going to study art history. And I was there for a few months. One of the first things we were billeted to do was to collect, it was a seasonal gallery, and we had to collect some of the works that had been sent around the world over the winter for various exhibitions and bring them back to the Academia. There's a room in the Academia where we prized open the crates, and there was been a big Jackson Pollock exhibit. And I'd never been a Jackson Pollock fan. I always thought, you know, what's the point, you know, splashing paint and, you know, it felt so random to me. I liked something a little bit more figurative and all that. And the light was coming through the window of this top room in the academia, and someone prized open the lid, and there was lots of us standing around, and the canvas was revealed and the light hit it and it came alive. It was the most extraordinary moment. It was just what I thought was gray paint was silver, and it moved and the light moved around. It was like water. It was a living thing. And if you've ever seen the documentary of Pollock painting, he's standing over the canvases. He's literally, it's like a contact sport. He's totally engaged. And of course, he's outside the whole time. He's in wherever he was in the Hamptons, in Montauk, splashing the paint. You know, when people say to me, how's it, when you're doing a play, how's it going? I never know what to say, because you're in the painting. You're splashing the paint. And until you step back and hold it in the light, you don't know what it is. And it seems to me that the best part of being an artist is to be in the paint. You know, you just have to be in it. And if you're lucky enough to contrive the circumstances where you can stand there with paint in your hands, someone's going to pay money to come and look at that. It's a very, very fortunate place to live. And I feel like every time I'm there, I just feel like, yeah, I'm painting, you know, and or something's happening and it's alive, you know. So it's a constant. I mean, I feel the weird thing for me has been that feeling has increased as I've got older rather than decreased. And you say, do I miss the early days? Well, I miss the newness of it, but I don't miss the lack of freedom, and I don't miss the self-consciousness. I think when you get to a certain age, there's a fuck it that comes into everything. It's like, fuck it, you know what I mean? I'm going to do it because I can, and if it fails, it fails, and I'm big enough to take that on the chin. I've had enough successes, I'm going to try it. And for the first time in my life, I feel compelled to do things rather than making the decision. You know, the strategic part of your brain, particularly when you run a theatre, becomes very dominant, you know, what we need to do now when we're running the Donmar. We need a small cast, we need to do an American play, we need to do a new play, a revival, whatever it is, and you're sort of balancing stuff and you're part of that. And then you just stop thinking strategically and you just feel like, well, this isn't a decision. I just feel I must do this. And my last movie, Empire of Light, I probably the worst thing to do right now, a personal small movie that has a tiny potential audience, but I feel compelled to do it and I don't really feel I have a choice. Some things choose you and sometimes you choose the thing. And so I think that part of you opens up as you get older. And if people are still willing to give you money to do it, you're in a very fortunate place.
Let's talk about emotion in your work. Ali, when I see you, you've got this extraordinary look in your eyes sometimes. Almost a kind of 1,000-yard stare, sort of detachment, or actually it's a 1,000-yard stare inward. It seems like you're... your eyes are staring inward at something. Is that the feeling that you must bring to the music? What's going on for you there? And is it ever possible that your emotional engagement with a piece can be unhelpful?
Well, firstly, when I practice, it's a completely different thing. I did a masterclass a couple of weeks ago and I was trying to impart that to the students, how important it is that you have these two separate parts of you that you develop. You have your private practice and then your performance being self. Because when I practice alone, I have all these things that I need to achieve for various reasons, the technique or the stamina or the understanding of the music is very much like meditation, even to the point where you get rid of any problems, imperfections in your posture or your breathing technique. And I remember my teacher in Paris talking about, just look at the end of your bell, like you're blowing out a candle. And it's not vital that you do that, but it's just like in meditation, it's probably better that you're not kind of looking in all directions or whatever. It's just a case of like, okay, just get out of your visual stimulation part of your brain and just start to meditate and start to quieten everything down. And then you can do your work. And then you work on the music and you work in various different ways. If you're memorizing, me and my pianist have got all these techniques where if you have to memorize something, you should do it in four different ways, because then even if three of them fail, you've still got that fourth one left, which will save you. And then you do all of that work. And then when you're on the stage, you just have to forget about all of it and just tell the story with as much conviction as you possibly can. And sometimes that's really difficult. And sometimes you are fighting with something like boringly technical, like your valves got stuck or something, or the orchestra aren't playing the right tempo because you and the conductor are just not in sync enough, or a number of things. I went on stage for a big concert once with a broken toe, and there's always something. And you have to go back to that meditative state where you can bring that into your, you know, again, I'm super into this idea of talking about the flow.
Yeah,
you've got to just try and find it no matter what it takes. You've got to find it. Otherwise, it's going to be a very long few minutes or hours.
So you can't afford to get overwhelmed by your feeling for the music.
You have to find something that you truly love about everything you play, even if it's just an aspect of the piece. But in some of my music, you know, to get you away from this is really hard and this bit's, you know, the bit I'm dreading and, you know, how am I going to make it? You know, trumpeters are obsessed with their stamina, you know, because as we've already talked about, it's messy if you're not going to make it. And I was talking to my students about, you know, for an example, in the Haydn Trumpet Concerto, which is not a technically complex piece, but it is the pinnacle of the repertoire, because it's when you play it, you're expressing who you are at that moment when you play it, and it changes during your life. And in that piece, every phrase, you know, I can hear exactly the picture that I want to paint with that phrase, or what it says, or how it relates to another part of the piece, or how it relates with me and the second violins, or, you know, it's a constant living, breathing thing that you have to try and access to make it feel authentic.
And that never feels inaccessible to you? Can you always find it when you look for it?
No, it's hard. I mean, again, it's like the Hamlet idea that you're looking for it. And for me, it's like when I go to the opera, I've been to a fair few like mediocre operas, but I've been to one or two which I felt were life-changing and thrilling in every aspect. And so now I will happily just go to loads and loads of rubbish operas for the rest of my life, because I'm going to find another one or two that are, again, like utterly wonderful. And they won't be the ones that we expect, but everything just comes together. And that's what we're all looking for all the time, isn't it? Those performances that just change you or stay with you for the rest of your life.
You've never had a piece where you felt so much for it that actually it got in the way of
This Haydn Concerto was a bit like that, because it's, you know, I think it's the second movement's on the grade 6 syllabus and the first movement's on the grade 8 syllabus, I think. And so it's not insurmountable technically for people to play, but for trumpeters, it's like, you know, the Beethoven quartet, late quartets, you know, it's so difficult to do it justice. I went for a couple of years at the beginning of my career where I just didn't play it. I just didn't, because I thought I'm not ready for it. You know, there's lots of parallels that we always talk about, you know, with Bach and Shakespeare and, you know, the Haydn and Mozart are just, they're a particular thing. I find Bach it's impossible to ruin Bach, really. He was so strong and so fantastically robust. I could happily listen to only Bach for the rest of my life. I'm the most devoted fan. But you can't really destroy it. It just is. Whereas with Mozart and Haydn, they are like perfect souffles that you just get it slightly wrong and it's completely gone. You know, so there is music that you can tiptoe around and get closer during your lifetime until you think, yeah, actually, I'm ready. I know what I want to do with this piece. I know this person did it like this, that person did it like that, and it's not right. They've not understood it properly. I need to go and do it.
You sound exactly like an actor. That really is, you're talking about the great parts. Yes,
beloved. Sam, yes, Mr. Cake, may I?
Mendes.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, talking about, because, you know, although we're talking about Ali having her game face on when she comes out on stage, one of the things I really admire about her is how uningratiating she is when she's playing.
Yeah.
You know, some solo performers particularly tell you they're playing at the same time as playing. They have sort of mannerisms that have developed. We've seen them, you know. Exactly. There's a sort of, you know, yes, it's like their job is not only to deliver the music, but to tell you how you should receive it as well.
Yes.
Right? You know what I'm saying? And Ali does not do that. She does not do that. No, it's like a purity. There's something very direct. I'm here to deliver this, and then I'm going to go away. Yeah. But I'm not going to tell you how to listen to it. And there is a real lesson there for actors too, because sometimes people think too much about how something is being perceived and not enough of simply about the truth of the scene and the situation, whatever it is. I heard you listened with great enjoyment to your interview with Jez and Laura.
Yeah, Laura.
And Laura is and he said, Jez said what I had said to him about Laura's particular extraordinary gift of, you know, we all know the actors that subtly adjust themselves to half face the house the whole time. It's almost something unconscious in an actor that they will tweak their body, open up their shoulder, you know, and she just doesn't know how to do it. She doesn't think about it. If I put her square on to someone on stage, like face in profile, she remains absolutely in profile.
You described it, I think, as all actors, to a greater or lesser extent, have a contract with the audience, meaning I am subtly favouring myself to include you so that we are all, I know that you're with me, to a greater or lesser extent. You said, in Jez's words, that Laura is the only actor you met who has no contract.
None at all. I mean, and I don't think she knows that she doesn't. She just knows only what the character wants to achieve in the scene, nothing else. And when people talk about the great Brechtian actors, you know, all the great years of the Royal Court in the 60s with Bill Gaskell and John Dexter, I think of that kind of, or Lindsay Anderson, absolutely concrete simplicity that she can provide. It's quite unfashionable, but it's beautiful to watch. And it's rare because a lot of the time an actor is not only playing the role, but making a case for the role as well. Mm. And you do not want them to be making a case for the role. I see that on film all the time, you know. And it's, you know, sort of, I want to control how I am perceived is a terrible thing to have in your head as a performer. And I find in Ali that it's not, you know, I'm going to do the best I can, which is absolutely appropriate. And I'm going to deliver what I think this person meant, but I'm also going to deliver it. I'm going to listen, I'm going to look behind the note. This is a really tricky thing to describe. It's not just the notes. It's not just the exercise. It's not just playing them all in the right order. It's phrasing. It's intonation. It's breath. It's control. It's like a sort of wave. You know, when you hear a great musician tackle something, they have a control of the phrasing of it, which I think with the trumpet is incredibly difficult because of the technical demands, whereas much easier with the violin or piano to control the way that something, you know, just the literally the dips and rises in something. And that, I think, is... something I really have learnt from and admire. Yeah?
Well, we're talking quickly about Hills of California. Sam, you told me recently when you were rehearsing it that you were sort of in a dream state. You felt that it felt unusual to you because, and I described it almost like sort of method directing, if there is such a thing, that you went somewhere. Does that seem, do you recognise that, Ali? In the delivery of this play? Can you talk a bit about that, Sam? Why? And what that felt like?
I felt like we were already in a strange situation because I was directing the work of a male playwright of my own age and ethnicity and sexual orientation, but it was entirely about women. It was a very odd situation. You know, here's me and Rob Howell, the designer, surrounded by a brilliant female production team otherwise, great female producers and an extraordinary cast led by all the women. And I felt like I needed to put myself in a place that was simply not me, 100% not me, at the same time as retaining a sense of the shape and the rhythms of the play. So I felt I've never been so close to my daughter, my wife, my mother. I just had to be. I was like, and I didn't mean that. I didn't think of them all the time. But you can't, in a play that basically revolves around the rape of a girl, you have a daughter of your own, you can't not think about it all the time. So it felt like a very disturbing place to be, but I had to go there with them and just be there for them and trust them. And it's a very unusual because you also have to, you know, the tricky thing about theatre directing with actors is that you're on film, you know, and this is a truism, but, you know, it's possible to trick an actor into giving a performance on film. You don't want to have to, but if you read Billy Wilder on directing Marilyn Monroe, you know, he tricked her a lot of the times, take 70, you know, he wanted a particular reaction, you know, he would do something to get that reaction. You only had to get it once. And that's true of all actors on film. But on stage, they have to not only do it, they have to know what part of them did it, and they have to understand how that might be recreated the following night, day, sometimes 8 shows a week, for months. And that's when it's a very emotional play, that's a very hard place to be. So you're having to understand the sources of the pain, you have to understand the sources of the upset, and you have to ask them, politely and with great respect, to revisit that source every night. You can't trick your way out of it, and technique won't get you there. Only a level of emotional empathy and understanding and just intuition and bravery. And I do think, you know, in Motive of the Cue, Gielgud says, bravery demands it and acting is bravery. And I really think that, you know, I think it's I was saying before when we were chatting in the dressing room, when the rare occasion I'm backstage 10 minutes before the show goes up for some reason, I just think nothing could persuade me to do this. Nothing. It's just the sheer terror that exists in those spaces, that it's what Emily Mortimer talks about, you know, just it just seems that without that leap, you know, nothing will ever be performed. And it's the difference in, we had to audition babies, six-month-old babies for the ferryman. How would you, ladies and gentlemen, audition a baby? Okay, well, this is how we worked it out, and it worked, but it was really interesting what came up because of it. We would put the baby in a show situation, and that meant the mother would stand in the wings, give it to the stage manager. There was a blackout. The music played loud. The baby had to be brought on stage, laid on the floor on a changing mat, and the stage manager would then leave the stage, and the lights would come up with the music on a baby lying alone on a West End stage, okay? And the audience would sort of like look at what appeared to be an empty stage, and they're like, holy shit, there's a fucking baby there. And then there would be a kind of, and then the baby, you know, if it was any good, you know, and you paid it decently, it would start to move, and you'd be like, and they were like, it's a real baby, you know, there would be that, because there was a slight thing, is it a doll or what is it? So you would have 10 babies that you would, or say, auditioning 20, and 9 out of 10, okay, the mother would come and you'd be very, you know, thank you so much, thinking all the time, why would you do this to your baby? But anyway, and you would, thank you so much for bringing little, you know, Jenny in, and let's try it, you know. And 9 out of 10 would just scream the fucking house down. And I'd be like, I don't blame you. Absolutely don't blame you. And then 1 out of 10 would be like, this is great. This is great. What's that noise? What are those lights? And that's the actor. That's the actor. And I'm telling you, that baby, if it was able to do that, almost never cried. Every time, loved it. And then the mothers would say, because they would have 4 shows on, 4 shows off or whatever, you know, Dickensian child labor laws. No, I'm joking. When they were off, they were like, exactly that time, where's the music? Where's the light? They you had sort of acclimatized them to this thing, you know. This part of themselves was accessed. And I truly think that humanity is divided into those that can deal with the dark and those that can't, you know. And there are strange people like the 2 people sitting next to me who can deal with it, right? I mean, they just can. It's in them. Not only they know what's on the other side of it, which for most of us we never get to. And the other side of it is something extraordinary, terrifying, but it is extraordinary.
You were asking about the dream state.
Yeah.
And it is true that Sam does go to a dream state himself when he's doing theatre, actually. It's not just when it's a really intense subject. When you're in the theatre, he goes deep within himself. And it's usually quite near the beginning when you're working out what you're going to do. And then about roughly 2/3 of the way through, you go more into the place that you go to when you're doing a film. You access different tools within yourself. But the dream state is very marked, is very obvious. He's completely gone into this other place where he needs to come up with great ideas. And then you spend the rest of the time trying to give them to other people.
I remember going to see Sam during the technical rehearsals, famously brutal technical rehearsals for the musical of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. You sat backstage with this sort of dark, brooding storm cloud over your head. And all you could say to me was, I'm having a lot of trouble with my Oompa Loompas.
What I wouldn't have given for one Oompa Loompa named Hugh Grant, you know what I mean? Yes. As opposed to, actually, I had to say, all the Oompa Loompas were great in that brush, but yes, God, it was...
They were marvellous.
It went on forever.
If you're listening, Oompa Loompas.
Yeah.
I cannot keep you any longer, though I could and wish we had the time. But the infallible timepiece in my stomach tells me I'm hungry. Time for us to go to dinner and let these people out into the light. Sam, Ali, thank you both so much for giving this good time. Sam Mendes, Alison Morton, ladies and gentlemen.
All right. There they go, off out of the stage door together, arm in arm, the director and the trumpeter. Ladies and gentlemen. Their shared dreams of finding the perfect chord, being in the painting, always being in the painting, never losing the remote, and always, always leaving one last sausage roll. Oh, what an intense joy to talk to my 2 old pals and try imperfectly to understand a little more about how they do the incredible things they both do. The ways in which their artistic lives overlap, the ways they don't, the mystery, didn't you think? The mystery of the music, where it comes from, how it's found, and that facility that Sam has to find a kind of deeper revelation in moments of his life, unwrapping that Jackson Pollock painting in the Guggenheim Museum in Venice, when he was a young man. Or finding a deeper relevance behind the awful, frankly, idea of making newborn babies cry or not cry in the services of the drama. That phrase that Ali used about Sam being a big match player obviously applies to both of them. And the deep reverence they have for each other's talent. And, I suppose, the sort of air of unspoken mystery about what the other does too. Because how can anyone really understand another's artistic life, even if you live with them, even if you're as invested as they are in each other's worlds? There's always a certain inevitable mystery there, isn't there? So cool, so moving, and so meaningful for me that those shared reflections now exist. Thank you so much, Sam and Ali. Thank you, Lord and Lady Mendez. Even if I was the first Lady Mendez, it means such a huge amount to me that you gave me your time. And thank you so much to everyone at German Street who makes these live shows possible. It's such an exciting little space, that. It really is. If you haven't seen a play there, do yourself a favour and go see it. They have a huge hit show on their hands right now called The Lonely Londoners by the brilliant Roy Williams. 5-star reviews across the board. I think it's only got a couple of weeks to go. But if you can catch it, you should. Yeah, the space has a kind of magic to it. Thank you, Stella, who runs the joint. Thank you to David, who helps her run the joint. Thank you to Annie, who brilliantly stage manages. Thank you to Balash, who does the sound. Thank you to Stephen, who takes the photographs. Thanks to all of you, really. It's a great honour to come and do these shows there. And thank you to you. If you came and bought a ticket for the live shows, or you're listening to it wherever you listen to it, thank you so much for accompanying me on these journeys into the lives of these great artists. It's such fun for me. Next week, speaking about the lives of great artists, 2-time Tony Award winner, a man who's been sort of famous in the theatre and the wider world since he was about 19 years old. He is on stage in London right now in his 5th project on a Neil Simon play. He's the great interpreter of Neil Simon's work. He is Ferris Bueller. He is the brilliant Matthew Broderick. Come listen to my chat with Matthew next week. I hope you can.
Stage, stage, stage door, Johnny. Stage, stage, stage door.